Well, comrades, this session on dialectical materialism is a very important subject, I feel, for the British Marxists in particular, due to the traditions in Britain in terms of a lack of theory, in terms of its philosophy and its history, which has been subject to quite a profound influence of empiricism, particularly since the successful bourgeois revolution of the 17th century and the development of the scientific revolution. There's been a concentration on facts and breaking things down into their separate components, which obviously has a great value as far as science is concerned. It's a very important step forward to analyse things in that kind of fashion. But the British bourgeois was always very empirical in the sense that it didn't require great theories in order to come to power, conquer power, develop its power, which is different from the bourgeois on the continent. In its tradition, that is the French Revolution or even the German tradition, is much more theoretical and deal with broader generalisations. In Britain, that's not the case. And for that matter, in the Anglo-Saxon countries, it's not the case. Therefore, it's particularly important that we look at and we study dialectics as the basic method of Marxism. In fact, Trotsky explained in Defense of Marxism that it is important for us to practice dialectics in the same way as a pianist does finger exercises and practices on the piano. So a Marxist should also practice in familiarizing themselves with dialectics, dialectical processes, and so on, and to combat the erroneous theories of empiricism or pragmatism and so on, which in particular have a great bearing in the British labour movement, which has a very a significant outlook basing itself on this empiricist view. So we have to look at these broader generalisations, very important, for they allow us to appreciate more what we are doing, what we're involved in, the environment in which we're involved in, and how everything relates together. And of course, they do seem a bit abstract, and we have to understand how these abstract conceptions link into the day-to-day work of ourselves. As far as we're concerned, we understand also that the ruling ideas of society are the ideas of the ruling class. They dominate through their newspapers, through the television, through the mass media. They control and ownership of these institutions, together with education, church, and so on. They're able to put out the propaganda, and therefore the general ruling ideas in society are the ideas of the ruling class, and those ideas are there in order to justify the existing society and the existing exploitation of society as something normal, natural, and so on and so forth. And if we are to challenge the capitalist system and challenge the ideology of capitalism and to understand what is going on around us, then we have to look at things in a different way. We have to try and discover the truth and to understand the context that we work in. And we have to develop our own and different world outlook, a different way of looking at society and how things develop. And this is what Marxism explains as dialectical materialism. It's the method of Marxism, our approach, our outlook on the world. And it's linked into a theory of knowledge, of logic. The reason why I raise the question of logic is that we are taught various aspects of logic. In fact, you could say that the rule of the logic of the last 2,000 years based upon Aristotle, a formal logic, has been the basis of all the things that we do on a day-to-day basis. And it's very important, and it serves as a correct basis for understanding things. But it has its limits. The basis of Aristotle's logic is that of A equals A, or a loaf of bread equals a loaf of bread, a law of identity. Also that A is A and B is B. And a loaf, if you like, is not a car. Is the law of difference. And last but not least, we have A is A and B is B, then they cannot change places. The excluded middle, which is just another way of expressing the other two forms of logical argument. And this basis of formal logic holds true for all everyday things. We use it in our when we get up in the morning, when we go to bed, we use it to identify things, what we're doing, and so on and so forth. It's the basis of all our activities, and has been for at least since human beings have come into existence. As I explained, although this allows us to reason and to understand, it has its limits, because it confines itself not to processes, but to things which are static, shall we say, things that do not change. And as far as things do not change, then formal logic is a very good way of reasoning and understanding things. But as soon as you have the element of change which enters into the equation, then formal logic finds it very difficult to understand. In other words, once you've introduced the concepts of change, of motion, then formal logic breaks down, because it's only interested in categorizing different groups and identifying things at that particular level. But if you have things which are changing in and of themselves, then A becomes something different, and therefore doesn't fit into the logic of formal logic. So it deals with so formal logic requires fixed categories, whereas the world itself is not based on fixed categories. The world itself is full of processes, of transformations, of movement, of flux, of development, of change, of continual change. And therefore, if we were to understand the world in its reality, not as a static item, but in its transformation and change, then we have to look at it in a different way. That logic cannot understand that. It cannot grasp this form of change. Only dialectics, materialist dialectics, is able to appreciate things in their motions, in their development, in their coming into being and moving away. Trotsky once explained that dialectics does not overthrow formal logic, but it raises things into a higher level by combining the best of formal logic into a different system. In other words, he compared it to higher and lower mathematics. He also compared it to the relationship between a still photograph and a movie, where the movie doesn't abolish the still photograph, but it combines the still photograph in a certain way and the certain laws which expresses and shows a far richer view of life when you see things in motion, in a real living form. And dialectics attempts to do that. Rather than seeing things in their isolation, it attempts to see themselves in its context and how they're likely to develop, what they've developed from, what they are now, and what they will develop to in the future. So this is a very important aspect, because everything is in constant flux, everything is in change. That's why formal logic doesn't answer those complicated questions which require a long drawn out process, or things which are in rapid change. So dialectics allows us to appreciate and understand things in their real existence. It also, the full name of this method is not simply dialectics, but dialectical materialism, which again is another key feature of Marxism. It is a materialist outlook on society. And Marx explained that there were two fundamental schools of thought in philosophy, in this world outlook, which compete with one another. One which is materialism, and the other which is idealism. And the first thing we should note is that when we use these terms, we're not using them in the everyday sense of the word materialism and idealism, whereby someone who's an idealist has virtue, looking for ideals and so on. Someone who's a materialist seems to be, you know, greedy, looking for material things. That's not what we mean by philosophical idealism or philosophical materialism. It's a different conception altogether. What we understand by idealism is the belief that ideas are primary and that matter is secondary, that the material world is a reflection of some idea. In relation to Hegel, the great philosopher Hegel, he saw it was the was an idealist. He saw that the prime motive force of history and society and nature was the absolute idea, and the material world was but a pale reflection of this perfect idea, which exists out of time and out of space. And this the idealism has a great sway, it seems. When you look at, well, how can people believe in these things? But it has a great sway in society and on philosophy. But the idealist believes that everything springs from thought, that objects are nothing but are really perceptions in the mind. You even have the situation where this is drawn to to its limits by the denial of any material world whatsoever, and that everything is simply an idea, and that we cannot know anything else but the real world. So it's a very obscure view, but this leads to mysticism, and it can lead to religion. And idealism, as far as we're concerned, is not the view of society. On the contrary, we stand in the materialist tradition, whereby we explain materialism as ideas are a reflection of the material world in which we live. That materialism recognizes the material world independent of our mind or our ideas or our perceptions. It exists independently of us. That ideas and thoughts are simply the product of a material brain, and that the brain itself has evolved with the human species in particular, which has developed a large brain and is able to generalize conceptions, and we can obviously think things through on the basis of observing the material world in which we live. But what we have to grasp is that ideas are a product of this material brain, and they're linked to the material brain. And prior to the human beings coming into existence, where there was no consciousness, where there was no thought, as there was no brains, the independent material world existed without us. And that has been proved by natural science. We don't have to debate this, but natural science has proved that life, for instance, has existed. The planet of the Earth in which we exist on was created 4.6 billion years ago. That life emerged on the planet as single-celled creatures some 3.6 billion years ago. We have the evolution of life, which is recorded in the geological strata of the Earth. We have the records of 600 million years ago, the Cambrian explosion, whereby multicellular organisms in a very varied way emerged in a very short period of time. And we see the development of obviously different species, mammals, and eventually human beings. And human development can be traced back, it varies, you could say, between 30 and 100,000 years ago. And with that, you have the development of consciousness, the brain and consciousness, and the generalization of thought. But prior to that, the world existed, the planets existed, the universe existed, without us thinking of it. And that's our conception of nature itself. So images are really images of the external world that exist independently of us, and we understand through our sense organs. So it's through our sense organs we have these images, and it's through practice that we understand things and their relationships to other things and relationships to ourselves. And over time, human beings began to understand what nature was and their relationship to nature, bit by bit. Of course, they began with various explanations, spiritual explanations and so on. But as human society developed more and more, particularly with the advent of science, we developed a more rational view of how things come about and our place in society, in the universe, and so on and so forth. And this is a materialist view of society and of human development, whereby our understanding of society, our understanding of nature, is built up gradually on the basis of our development of our knowledge at each stage. If you like, knowledge is accrued gradually over a period of time, bit by bit, where false ideas are replaced by more correct ideas. There's a whole approximation taking place of what reality is like, and a picture emerges, and different theories emerge also, which reflect this relationship between practice and a theory and our observation of nature, which is linked into the development of science itself. So we understand that the world itself cannot be understood using the concepts of formal logic, although we use formal logic on a day-to-day basis, and it remains perfectly fine as a tool for day-to-day things. When it comes to broad conceptions of society, of nature, of the world, of the universe, of history, then we have to have a new method of understanding the way in which change occurs. And the concept of dialectics has also evolved over the last 2,000 years of an attempt to understand things in motion, things in their change, things in their real context. And right up to the recent period, probably the greatest persons who contributed most before Marx and Engels was Hegel, who analysed things, although an idealist, looked at things from a dialectical point of view. And it was on the basis of Hegel's contribution that Marx and Engels were able to rescue the dialectic from Hegel, take away the idealistic surroundings, this shell, put it back on its feet, if you like, in a rational explanation of the world itself. And Marxists have explained that matter is in constant motion, and that the universe is governed by certain laws, that we believe in causality, that things have causes, and our task is to look for the causes, look for the underlying laws which dominate our lives, dominate society. And we start on the basis that just nature has causes. It's not just something which has no rational explanation whatsoever. For instance, if we look at just through observation alone, we understand that the seasons change periodically, and they develop in a certain pattern, in a certain set pattern, and therefore they basically operate on a basis of a law, a natural law. And of course our task is to understand the laws of nature. If we understand the laws of nature, we can understand how nature is likely to develop and how we can intervene in nature and help things develop in a more conscious way as well. So if there exist these laws in nature, this necessity, if you like, of things happening, that we can see everything is a form of cause and effect. Everything has a cause. And every cause has an effect. And every effect has a cause. But the universe is so complex that you have a multitude, an infinity, if you like, of cause and effect. Cause and effect interacting on one another, interacting on everything else. So you see this phenomenal this pattern of cause and effect, where cause changes into effect, effect changes into cause in an enormous complex pattern, if you can envisage this. I think it was Lenin, which I got a quote from, which sums up his conceptual. He's quoting what Hegel thought of dialectics, which gives you a bit of an idea if you think about what this means. And he compared it to a river. But when you think about it, this is a quote from Lenin, who's looking at Hegel's conception of nature. And he compared it to a river. A river and the drops in the river. The position of every drop, its relation to the others, its connection with the others, the direction of its movement, its speed, the line of the movement, straight, curves, circular, etc., upwards, downwards, the sum of the movement, concepts as registration of individual aspects of the movement, of individual streams, etc. There you have approximately the picture of the world according to Hegel's logic. Of course, minus God and the absolute. And I think that's quite a graphic illustration of the interpenetration of everything, the unity of the universe, the unity of nature, of everything interconnecting with every other, if you like. And dialectics, as Engel said, is the science of interconnections, how everything is interconnected and how we understand this connection. So not only is it change, continual flux, a complete interaction, one thing changing to its opposite again and again and again, is a fascinating look at how nature is. And how different that is from formal logic, where you attempt to put everything in little tidy boxes with no relation to one to the other. So it's a very rich and complex view of nature and the world, of an interaction between everything. And here in this, you have an external necessity. Laws exist in this endless sea of apparent accidents, isn't it? Everything seems to be accidental, and yet within this sea of accidents, you have particular laws affecting one another. You know, there's a necessity within these accidents, and as Marx explained, Engels explained it, the necessity, these laws, are expressed through accident. An apparent accident, like the First World War, was supposed to be caused by the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, which is an accident, and yet within that event unfurled the whole necessity of the First World War. All the building up contradictions within society, you know, if they culminated in this assassination, which resulted in a trigger, would set up all this multiplicity of other things. It's an accident, but within the accident is revealed the necessity of the war itself, of powerful causes which are developing within society and driving it forward. So as Hegel explained, necessity expresses itself through accident, which is a very unusual way of understanding things. And accidents, well, what is an accident? An accident is, has a cause, but it may be so obscure that it just seems apparent that there's no accident. It's an accident. There's no real cause to it because it's so far into the past that you find that the reason for this. But these are revealed through the very necessity itself of these laws. So dialectics attempts to understand these laws. What are the laws governing change? Obviously, there are different laws and different levels, if you like, of laws according to different aspects of nature. And what we're able to understand and gain from looking at nature in its various forms and developments is that it's driven by certain general laws. And these general laws were turned into dialectical laws. Dialectics really is an abstraction of what really happens in society, the dialectics of nature, as Engels put it, that the all these processes are taking place in a certain way, and we generalize these processes and turn them into theory. And the first law of dialectics is the change from quantity into quality. There is accumulation of quantitative changes at a certain point, result in a leap and a change in the quality of the substance we're talking about. It also has the opposite, that the change in quality can result into a change in quantity. Again, it's a very important law of dialectics. Another one, the interpenetration or unity of opposites. A unity of opposites within nature itself. The struggle of opposites within a certain phenomenon, which gave rise to an internal conflict, an internal tension, which gives rise to motion, change, fundamental change, leaps. Of course, you have periods where we have static development, and then there's a profound change, a break in the situation, as we know, that's the cause of a revolution. Again, it's what a fundamental difference between our outlook of a revolutionary, which would give you this conception, and the idea of reformism, if you like, in the movement, which is bit by bit, gradually, over a long period of time, will change society, isn't it? This idea of formally, empirically, bit by bit, build like building blocks. There's no dynamic to it, but it's really a reflection of an empirical view of society as well. But to go back to the question of dialectics, we understand that things do not move in a straight line. It's not a linear process like vulgar evolution of a bit by gradual bit development of things. The evolution takes place in a different form, where you have convulsions, revolutions, leaps, breaks in continuity. These are the real substance of nature and life. And that's why we need a concept to understand this. And dialectics tries to teach us to look at things in this particular way, in the real way, not in a static world we apparently see, you know, around us. Although if you look at the stock markets and the weather, all these things are chaotic systems and graphically illustrate the rapid changes that take place in society, in society, and cannot be grasped by formal logic. Another task also is to understand these laws in which they work themselves out. And this has raised the question also, which is very interesting for Marxists to understand, the relationship between freedom and necessity. We know that, as I mentioned, the weather, we see the necessity of the laws of the weather which take place. In fact, it's quite clear that you cannot, at this point in time, know with any accuracy or after 3 days what the weather is going to be like. It's very chaotic. But there are certain laws and patterns to this development. So we know it's chaotic, but it exists. And the question of necessity and freedom for Marxists is man becomes free, or human beings become free, not by trying to escape the laws of nature, to try and to distance ourselves from the laws of nature, but to understand the laws of nature. Because if you understand something, you can modify it, or at least you can plan with it, work with it, in order to reach a certain end. And the more you understand the laws, the more you appreciate those laws, the more you can link yourselves to those, that understanding, the more free you are to act. There's also the conception of matter, which must be not an abstract thing, but exists within time and within space. Obviously, laws of nature, as far as we're concerned, apply at every level of the universe. There's one universe, one material world, in which the laws of physics, laws of nature, apply everywhere. It can't be one set rules here, one set there, and that we haven't discovered. It has to apply everywhere, because we believe there's one infinite universe. And this raises the cool question of infinity, that the universe is not a closed universe, or there's not a number of universes with their own different laws. What we're looking at here is one universe which is infinite in every form, in every way you look, is infinite, in which you have finite parts. That's the paradox. The universe is infinite but made up of finite parts, whether it be planets, solar systems, or what have you. These are finite things, and they evolve, but you have an infinite universe itself. That's why we reject the idea of the Big Bang, if you want to go back to that favourite of ours, that the Big Bang, where it's supposedly at 12 billion years ago, 15 or 20 billion years ago, there was a bang in which all the matter of the universe was created. The universe was created, the laws of physics were created, time was created, and matter was created. And we say, well, that's a very mystical view of, it's like the creation view of life itself. Well, what created it? What started this bang then? What is it? It comes back to the idea of God created this initial impulse, as they call it in English, the initial impulse was created by a supreme being which starts the universe and so on and so forth. We don't believe that is the case, because if you started the universe, well, what comes before the universe then? And what comes before that? And what comes before that? It becomes a nonsense if you do not understand that it's an infinite universe of matter and constant changes in the forms of matter. But still, this infinity exists in that fashion. Time didn't begin. It always has always been there. Time is part of matter. Space, matter has to exist in time, has to exist in this space. And motion and matter are part and parcel of the same phenomenon. This matter has to be continually evolving, developing, and changing its form from one form to another. But what we have is the unity of matter. We do not need religion. We do not need a god. We don't need superstition. We take a view of the unity of the world and the unity of the universe as our starting point, an infinite universe. So there's no boundaries to the universe. By the way, there's no boundaries to our understanding as well. And the deeper we go, we see that, you know, that there's always there's this crave to find out the building blocks of matter. And they go from smaller and smaller and smaller. The greater the power of the microscope allows us to see further and further. But the more powerful it, the more further it opens up. It's like an infinite process, and we can't get to the bottom of it. Just like there's no, the whole thing is infinite. You cannot actually find the last possible building or the last thing. There's always new. Phenomena are thrown up at each particular stage. So we have to, there's no barriers to our knowledge. It's a question of our understanding of science and developing our theories and developing through practice our understanding of the universe itself. So there's no end to that. So we see ourselves in a material world where everything comes into being and dies away. But what Marx explained, which is more important, that Marx elevated these social sciences into a social theory and transformed socialism from a utopia into a science. And that is an understanding that's part of the historical development of society. and is not just a good idea, but will evolve as society develops. Of course, we have to understand the role of the working class itself. So dialectics allows us to comprehend the world in which we live. It prepares us, it gives us understanding of how to change society, so that on the basis of the overthrow of capitalism, the creation of class society, that we can take this leap, as Engels said, from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. Leave it there.
All right, thank you.